Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ecclesiastes chapter 8. I will call this chapter, Keep the King's Command. Solomon begins at verse 1. Who is like the wise man and who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. Just like Moses' face beamed when Moses came down from the mountain, he was full of the wisdom of God. A beaming face is the reflection of a tranquil conscience and a serene mind. Solomon was very big on having wisdom, and he was very big on contrasting that with folly. In fact, that's why we call all of his books wisdom literature, Proverbs, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes. We move now to Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verses 2 through 4. Solomon says, Keep the king's command because of your oath made before God. Do not be in a hurry. Leave his presence, and don't persist in a bad cause, since he will do whatever he wants. For the king's word is authoritative, and who can say to him, What are you doing? Now, this king who is making commands, it could either be the Messiah, as some have suggested, or it could be the earthly king. I believe it's the earthly king. I don't believe it's the Messiah. I don't think Solomon knew too much about the Messiah, unless you could say he's prophetically doing it, but it just doesn't fit here. It's the earthly king. Keep the king's command. Why? Because of your oath made before God. That would be the oath of allegiance and fidelity, assuming the king is the earthly king. We read in 2 Samuel 5, 1 through 3, that all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. This is after David had been ruling for 7 years apart from Jerusalem, while the descendants of Saul were ruling in Jerusalem. In verse 2, these representatives from the northern tribes came to David at Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem, and said, Previously, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in. And the Lord said to you, You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be a ruler over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with him. Now, covenant is the same thing as oath. I was taking a seminary class online, and the professor made a big deal about that and went through the scriptures showing how when you take a covenant, you're taking an oath. I never really noticed that before. So King David basically took an oath with the people of the tribes of Israel. And then they anointed David king over Israel. So in other words, when you are following the king, it's a covenant. I mean, you made an oath to follow that king. So you need to keep his commands. Now, this is assuming that the king's commands are not immoral. They might be stupid. But if the king says, I want you to go bow down and worship an idol, well, of course, you don't obey that kind of command. But normal kingly type government things, you obey the king. Now, some people say that this oath is not the subject's oath to the king, but it's the oath of God. That could be the your, keep the king's command because of your oath. In the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, that your is in brackets, which means it's not in the original text. Keep the king's command because of oath before God is the literal. Now, this is the translation that is preferred by those who think that this king that's supposed to be obeyed is the Messiah. And so God's oath that he would be taking is that he's going to punish his transgressing children. And I think this is an extreme stretch, but this is what some commentators say. A verse backing up that interpretation, Psalm 89, verses 30 through 35. If his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will punish their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. But I will not break off my loving kindness from him, nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate. My oath I will not violate. In other words, he's going to punish those who transgress against him. Well, all of that is learned speculation. I think it's just simply easy to say, keep the king's command because you've sworn to obey the king. In verse 3, Solomon says, Do not be in a hurry. Don't leave his presence. Don't persist in a bad cause. In other words, don't go off in a huff. Don't leave the king in a heat of passion, withdrawing from the king's court and service. And especially if you leave, don't join a rebellion. Don't persist in a bad cause. Since the king can do whatever he wants. In other words, the king can catch you and put you in jail or cut your head off. Verse 4, for the king's word is authoritative. And again, we're assuming normal matters of government. It does not mean that one should not leave government in extreme circumstances. For example, if Adolf Hitler tells you to murder a Jew or put a Jew into a gas oven, no, you have the moral duty to say, no, I'm not going to do that. But assuming normality, the king is the boss, you obey him. You don't say, what are you doing, king? What are you telling me this for? The application to today is very simple. If the boss asks you to jump, you ask, "How high, sir?" Now, I have said that I don't believe this king that Solomon is talking about is the Messiah, but Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown think so, and he says that earthly kings don't have authoritative power in verse 4. The king's word is authoritative. That can't be an earthly king, because no earthly king can give commands that obey it all the time, so this must be the Messiah. Well, that's a weak argument, in my humble opinion. I think that Solomon just means in normal circumstances, the king's word is authoritative. We go now to Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verses 5 through 8. The one who keeps a command will not experience anything harmful, and a wise heart knows the right time and procedure. Again, Solomon is saying, obey the king. If you do, everything will be all right. You won't experience anything harmful. And a wise heart knows the right time and procedure. There's a way to obey, then there's a way to obey not in such a good way. In other words, you give lip service to what the king says. You drag out your obedience. Yeah, I'll do it next month. Verse 6, for every activity there is a right time and procedure, even though man's troubles are heavy on him. Yet no one knows what will happen, because who can tell him what will happen? No one has authority over the wind to restrain it, and there is no authority over the day of death. There is no furlough in battle, and wickedness will not allow those who practice it to escape. In verse 6, Solomon says, for every such activity there is a right time and procedure, and just like I said, you do it now, don't drag it out forever. Also, you do it properly with the right procedure. In other words, don't just give technical legal compliance to the order, but do it with a whole heart, a full heart, even if you don't agree with what the command was. I keep thinking of management applications here, people in business. Even though man's troubles are heavy on him, even though it's hard to carry out the king's orders properly, because a lot of times a king will tell you something that's stupid, the boss. It's either stupid or it's difficult. Sometimes they'll tell you something that's difficult, and yet it's better for the organization, even though you don't understand that because you're at the lower levels of the organization. But Solomon says, obey the king at the right time, with the right procedure, even though it's hard to obey him, even though the troubles of your obedience are heavy on you. Verse 7, Solomon says, yet no one knows what will happen, because who can tell him what will happen? Now, who is this no one who does not know what will happen, and to whom no one can tell what will happen? Who is this person that Solomon is talking about? Here's four options. The king, who is said to be wicked. Cambridge commentary says apparently it's referring to a wicked king who gives a command. The pulpit commentary says it's more probably a wicked king giving a command. Cambridge says he goes on with infatuated blindness to the doom that lies before him. He doesn't know what's coming after him. That's so. Verse 7, yet this wicked king doesn't know what's going to happen, and no one can tell him, and boom, he's finished. Now, verse 8 mentions at the very end, wickedness will not allow those who practice wickedness, to escape. That sort of encourages us to take this option, but I don't believe that's what it is. I think it's a good king, or a normal king that Solomon is talking about. Here's option number 2. Solomon is just referring to mankind in general. Nobody can tell what's going to happen in the future. Pulpit commentator says maybe that's it. Pool commentator says yes, that's what it is. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown for option number 3 say it's the sinner in general. Yet no sinner knows what will happen, because no one can tell him what will happen. That's very similar to the idea that the person being talked about is the sinful king. But in my humble opinion, and I don't have a commentator to back me up on this, but I think this is what is being said here, the one who keeps the king's command at the proper time with the right procedure is who is being talked about here. He does everything right, he does everything at the proper time, and yet he still doesn't know if everything will work out all right. He cannot know if the king will be pleased with him, but you're supposed to obey anyway. Thus, verse 8 is just an example of why it's no good to assume that you can control all the outcomes of your actions. Because in verse 8, Solomon says, no one has authority over the wind to restrain it. So you can follow the king's command at the right time with the right procedure, and still things don't work out, because just like you can't control the wind, you can't control events. Might not turn out so good, even though you do the right thing. Next, in verse 8, there's no authority over the day of death. Nobody can control that. Likewise, you can't control circumstances, even when you obey the king at the right time with the right procedure. Next, there's no furlough in battle. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible, no furlough in battle. That's not a really good translation to me. NASB has no discharge in battle. In other words, once you're fighting, You're not getting out of it. You can't get out of what's going to happen even though you obey the king. All this is referring back to verse 6 when Solomon says, for every activity there is a right time and procedure, even though man's troubles are heavy on him, and then the troubles is what makes things unpredictable. But he's saying, go ahead and do it anyway at the right time and procedure, even though no one has authority over the wind to restrain it. There's no authority over the day of death. Things are beyond your control. There's a lot of contingency, a lot of chance of life. But even still, even though all that is true, obey the king at the right time with the right procedure. So there's no discharge in battle. You can't get out of it. Wickedness will not allow those who practice it to escape. Just as the wicked man cannot escape the consequences of his folly, so you, the one who is obeying the king at the right time with the right procedure, you cannot escape from consequences which might follow. Now that is an iffy interpretation. I realize the passage in verses 5 through 8 are a little bit difficult. The verses in verses 5 through 8 are a little bit difficult, but I think that's the way to go here. Now one little rabbit trail. In verse 8, Solomon says there's no discharge in battle, no furlough in battle, no discharge. This is referring to military service for all Jews above 20 years old, or it could be referring to that. But that introduces an apparent contradiction, so we need to look at this. Numbers 1 through 3 says, from 20 years old and upward, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies. So everybody from 20 years old was enlisted on the military rolls, but there were exemptions. In Deuteronomy 20, verses 5 through 8, we read, the officers also shall speak to the people, saying, who is the man that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise, he might die in the battle, and another man would dedicate it. In other words, we're going to give a break to somebody who just built his house. Verse 6, who is the man that has planted a vineyard and has not begun to use its fruit? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise, he might die in the battle, and another man might begin to use his fruit. So if you just planted a vineyard, you get a break, which is pretty humane, if you ask me. And then in verse 8, then the officers shall speak further to the people and say, who is the man that is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his heart. So the cowardly didn't have to go fight. We don't want cowards in the army. Of course, the coward would have to go back and face shame and opprobrium from his wife and from his kids and from his neighbors. But at any rate, he doesn't have to go to war. So there are times when people are discharged from having to fight in battle, and yet Solomon says in verse 8, there is no discharge in battle. How do you explain that? Does that create a contradiction? Well, here's a couple of ways you can avoid the contradiction. You can say, well, perhaps there was no discharge, none of these exemptions, like if you built a house, built a vineyard. Perhaps in time of war, these situations didn't apply because of necessity. We're in trouble here. We've got to fight. I think the Yom Kippur War was fought on Yom Kippur, which is not exactly the time that you were supposed to be fighting a war. But if you didn't, Israel would have died. The nation of Israel would have been destroyed, the modern nation of Israel. So that's one way to look at it. But I think the easiest way to look at it is to say that there are no discharges in battle, meaning that once the battle is started, obviously you're not going to say, oh, I got to go home and take care of my vineyard. So these exemptions in Deuteronomy 20, verses 5 through 8, are referring to, in general, not when the battle's already started. We go to Ecclesiastes 8, verses 9 through 10. Solomon says, all this I have seen and applied my mind to every deed that has been done under the sun, wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt. So then, I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place, and they are soon forgotten in the city where they did this. This, too, is futility. The first question I have here is, what do verses 9 through 10 have to do with verses 1 through 8? Verses 1 through 8, we see Solomon exhorting people to obey the king. And then in verse 9, Solomon talks about people who have exercised authority over another man, presumably somebody who was supposed to obey the king, but that authority over the other man has been to that other man's hurt. And I guess what Solomon is saying is, look, you have to obey the king. But a lot of times you obey the king and bad things happen. You just can't get around it. That's why he says that's futility. Meaningless. What can you say? What can you do? Now, when Solomon says in verse 9 that he has seen all these deeds under the sun where man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt, who's the his? The man being oppressed, the man who has the authority exercised over him unjustly? That's the way I take it. But he could be to the oppressor's hurt. It hurts him. I don't think so. Could refer to both the oppressor and the oppressed. It's the oppressed, I think. The person who obeyed orders and then got screwed. Verse 10, so then I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place. Well, who are these wicked? Well, Gill and Clark say Solomon probably had in mind particularly wicked kings. And once again, verse 10, I have seen the wicked buried. That tends to encourage the interpretation in the first eight verses that the king who is supposed to be obeyed is a wicked king. And that very well could be. I didn't take that view, but it could be. We're still supposed to obey the wicked king at the right time with the right procedure, even though man's troubles are heavy on him. Verse 6, even though it's hard to do, even though it's to your hurt. Then Solomon takes care in verse 9 and 10 with this wicked king who gave the command that was so hard to obey. He says they're forgotten. As soon as they're buried, they're gone. Their memory is gone. Now these wicked, with it's a wicked king, he used to go in and out from the holy place. That would be the law courts, according to Gill, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Barnes, and Benson. Assuming it's talking about a wicked king. It doesn't actually say it's a wicked king in the verses. We're just assuming that. So the kings used to go in and out from the holy place at the gate where they exercised justice because they were the chief legal officer in the kingdom. It could be those who used to go in and out from the holy place. The holy place is the place where the wicked kings were buried. Those who used to go in and out would be translated, as Gill says, they came from the place of the holy. In other words, from the holy tomb where the king was buried. I don't think so. Adam Clark says, those who used to go in and out from the holy place is the sacred office which the king held. So the king used to go in and out of his kingship. That's a little abstract for me. Most commentators say it's the law courts. So they were big shots. They were the chief judicial officer, and now they're gone, forgotten, even though they gave commands which had to be obeyed and which should have been obeyed. Now, if this is true, this king back up in verses 1 through 8 is a wicked king, then what Solomon is saying, even though he's wicked, you need to obey him. If he's a good king, of course, one should obey the good king, even though you don't know what's going to happen. Either way, the interpretation goes, the exhortation remains the same. You're supposed to obey the king, unless it's in some situation where the king orders you to do something that is grossly immoral, of course. We go now to Ecclesiastes 8, verses 11 through 13. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow, because he does not fear God. Verse 11. This verse is for present-day America. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly. At this particular time, because of far-left prosecutors funded by George Soros, crypto-communist, there are prosecutors everywhere in big cities in America who will not prosecute crime. Therefore, the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil, and in these big cities, crime rates have skyrocketed. Now, I'm assuming in verse 11, the sentence against an evil deed is not executed by the human magistrates who have jurisdiction. This is not God. But it's true, God sometimes withholds his judgments against evil deeds to give sinners times to repent, and therefore, instead of repenting, then they go out. People go out and do evil instead of repenting. But I'm assuming this is the earthly king who is not doing his duty in executing justice. In verse 12, Solomon says, although a sinner does evil 100 times, and that would be because justice was not executed upon his head. So the sinner is going out and committing crimes 100 times over. Instead of stealing once, he's stolen 100 times. And he's lengthened his life. He should be executed. Let's say he's killed somebody, then he goes out and kills 99 more, and so he's still living when he shouldn't be. That's okay. Solomon says, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God. In other words, God's going to take care of this imperfect justice down here in the world. And it's not only those who fear God who will have it go well for them, but it's those who fear him openly, Solomon says at the end of verse 12. It's much easier to fear God in the privacy of your own home, but when you have to go into the public square and say that God says this and God says that, it takes a lot more guts. The implication here is, of course, that we should do that when necessary. Of course, that doesn't mean you go out and provoke wrath on your head by taunting the authorities, but it means that sometimes you have to speak the truth when you're challenged. Verse 13, Solomon says, "But it will not be well for the evil man. Even though they evaded earthly justice, nevertheless, it will not be well." John Gill says, "In life they have no solid peace and comfort. At death they will be turned into, at judgment they will hear the awful sentence, 'Go, ye cursed,' and will be tormented to all eternity." Now in the next part of verse 13, Solomon says, "This evil man will not lengthen his days, even though he has not been punished." Well, that introduces an apparent contradiction, because verse 12 says, "Although a sinner does evil and may lengthen his life, he evades justice and he lengthens his life, but nevertheless, he will not lengthen his life," in verse 13. So how do we avoid that contradiction? Here's some possible reconciliations. Option number one, verse 12 is hypothetical. Verse 12 says that the sinner may lengthen his life. May. So that's hypothetical. So this argument goes, but I don't think so. I don't think that sinners escaping justice is hypothetical. I'm sure Solomon saw a lot of actual cases of sinners escaping justice. Option number two, verse 12 is a rare case. Verse 13 is the general case. Verse 12, the rare case, "Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life." Yeah, that happens every now and then. But in verse 13, "The evil man will not lengthen his days in general." I don't think that's a good option. "For the evil man will not lengthen his days like a shadow." Well, that happens all the time. Think about Hugh Hefner. There's lots of Hugh Hefners in the world. I think the proper answer to this apparent contradiction is given by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. In verse 12, the sinner may lengthen his life. Apparently, he lengthens his life by evading justice 100 times when the courts don't convict him. But he does not lengthen his life in verse 13 because he's gone to hell. So you factor in the sinner's eternal existence, the lengthening of his days a little bit on earth because he's avoided earthly justice is nothing compared to living eternally in hell. His days are not lengthened that way. There's your answer right there. We go now to Ecclesiastes 8, verses 14 through 17, and we will finish this chapter. Solomon says, "There is a futility that is done on the earth. There are righteous people who get what the actions of the wicked deserve, and there are wicked people who get what the actions of the righteous deserve. I say that this too is futile. So I commended enjoyment, because there is nothing better for man under the sun than to eat, drink, and enjoy himself, for this will accompany him in his labor during the days of his life that God gives him under the sun. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe the activity that is done on the earth, even though one's eyes do not close in sleep day or night, I observed all the work of God and concluded that man is unable to discover the work that is done under the sun. Even though a man labors hard to explore it, he cannot find it. Even if the wise man claims to know it, he is unable to discover it. I say that this too is futile," in verse 14. What's futile? That the righteous don't get what they deserve and the wicked don't get what they deserve. Righteous people get what the wicked deserve, so righteous people suffer. Wicked people get what righteous people deserve, so wicked people get rewarded. That's meaningless. That's futile. That's disgusting. It happens all the time. As an ex-lawyer, that just burns me up when I see it, especially in politics. There has been so much injustice heaped upon innocent people, innocent politicians even. The criminal court system is politicized, and instead of trying to beat somebody at the ballot box, you take them to court. That's a common problem that people have. It's the way of life on this earth. There is no such thing as perfect justice. That reminds me of a story. A good friend of mine went to a lawyer in my hometown, a lawyer whom I knew, and my friend had gotten cheated out of something, but the amount of damage that was done to my friend was less than the lawyer's fee would be, so it wasn't worth pursuing the case. And so the lawyer told my friend, "Nah, there's no point in doing this. You're just going to have to let it go and eat it." And my friend, who is like me, he likes justice, he said, "I don't care about the money, I want justice." And that lawyer looked at him and said, "Sir, if you want justice, you need to go to a whorehouse." Ooh. My friend told that story over and over and over again, and I know what he meant. It bothered him that there was not justice in the world. And I saw this all the time, too. It still bothers me. So, no justice in the world, at least no perfect justice. So, what's the recommendation to do in that situation? Verse 15, Solomon says, "So I commended enjoyment, because there's nothing better for a man under the sun than to eat, drink, and enjoy himself." As John Gill says, it's much better to eat and drink and enjoy yourself than to fret over the prosperity of the wicked and the woes of the just. I take that to heart. I try to enjoy the sunrise every morning or the sunset, the quiet of the country where I live, the squirrels that run against my house and over my roof and on my porch, if the Celtics win a basketball game, that kind of thing, instead of getting all worked up over the lack of justice in the American court system. So I take this to heart. I like this. Now, Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that verses 14 and 15 are actually not words spoken by Solomon, but they are the words of an objector who does not have faith. And so this objector says, hey, there's no justice in the world, so let's just eat, drink, and be merry. We can't pursue justice. It's hopeless. I don't believe that. I believe Solomon was talking straight here. Don't worry about the lack of justice in the world. There's nothing you can do about it. I mean, if Solomon couldn't do anything about it, what can the average Joe do about it? Nothing. So go ahead and enjoy life. What did Paul say? God has given us all good things to enjoy. I think that was to the Philippians. Enjoy it, and don't worry about the evil that's in the world. I have a hard time with this. Had a hard time ever since I was a young teenage boy. I grew up during the Vietnam War, and I remember telling my mother, what's the point? What's the point of getting married? There's so much evil in the world. And she was unhappy to hear me say that, and for good reason, but she didn't have an answer. There is no answer. Why is there war in the world? Why is there such injustice? But just because there is war and injustice doesn't mean we shouldn't enjoy our lives on this planet as we proceed through this veil of tears. Now in verse 16, Solomon says, when I applied my mind to know wisdom, in other words, to understand why the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper, that's the particular type of wisdom he's talking about here. When I tried to learn that and tried to observe the activity that is done on the earth, and Solomon says I didn't close my eyes day or night, which is just an exaggerated way of saying he was very diligent in trying to find out why it is that the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper. Verse 17, Solomon says, I observed all the work of God and concluded that man is unable to discover the work that is done under the sun. In other words, can't figure out why God lets this to happen. The work of God refers to God allowing righteous to suffer and the wicked to prosper. Solomon can't figure it out. The problem of evil is a very difficult problem, but it's not only a problem for Christians, it's a problem for every philosophical system under the earth and every religion on this planet. Everybody has a problem with the problem of evil. So Solomon says that man is unable to discover, even a man such as himself who's very diligent and searching, he is unable to discover what God has done. That's just like what Paul says in Romans 11:33, oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. Ladies and gentlemen, there will always be things in this life that you cannot understand. Remember that old country hymn? Farther along we'll understand it. Farther along we'll understand why when we get to heaven. And all will be made right. And all justice will be done. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with Ecclesiastes chapter 8. We're now prepared in our next audio to go to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. I'm going to call Ecclesiastes chapter 9, Death Comes to All. A cheerful topic. I hope you stay tuned for it, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.